There's a better world, it's a coming, tell you why. There's a better world, it's a coming, tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world, it's a coming, tell you why. There's a better world, it's a coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world, it's a coming, don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back once again to Progressive News Network. This is our first show of 2014. We hope that this is an exciting year for all of us, and we hope the progressives begin to see the fruit of their long, long labors. We've got a wonderful show for you tonight. We've got Ed Buckner and his son Michael, who'll be talking about their book, In Freedom We Trust, An Atheist's Guide to Religious Liberty. The theme of the show is atheism, humanism, and morality in 2014. Now, we've also got Rob Boston, who is the communications director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. We've got Joe Beck, founder of the Treasure Coast Humanist Association. And we've got Reverend Greg Wilson, a Unitarian Universalist minister, to talk about these issues of morality in 2014, and is there a place for the atheist and the humanist in these discussions. And now, the news. No water for you. Just say no water to 300,000 plus. On Thursday, an estimated 300,000 residents of 9 counties in West Virginia were told they could not use or drink their tap water in any way after a chemical used to wash coil of impurities spilled from a holding tank into the Elk River. The spill prompted Governor Earl Ray Tomlin to declare a state of emergency, and 911 received more than 1,000 calls in the hours after the spill, with 4 or 5 people transported, and best that we know, to hospital by ambulance. According to the National Library of Medicine, repeated or prolonged exposure to the chemical 4-methoxycinone hexane methanol can cause headaches, irritation of the eyes, nose, and throat, and can cause skin rash. Nobody knows where the leak started, when the leak started, or how much has leaked into the Elk River, although first it was said that only a few 100,000 gallons leaked. Now it looks like they're admitting to 750,000 gallons. No one knows. They say they found the source of the spill at 4 p.m., but they had no way of knowing how long the chemicals had been leaking. McIntyre, president of the company, said he also didn't think the chemical was still leaking, but he didn't know the current status of the spill for sure. According to the Department of Environmental Protection spokesman, the state is confident no more than 5,000 gallons escaped, but only knows a certain amount that got into the river. Some of it was contained. Again, that number has been revised upward significantly, from 5,000 to 75,000. The water company has no contact with Freedom Industries. In other words, they're not speaking to Freedom Industries, the chemical polluter, the company that manufactures the spilled chemical. According to McIntyre, the company provided no notice of the spill. Hey, why even mention it? And hasn't been in communications with the water company so far. There's no process for testing the toxicity of the spilled chemical. And when the water company found out about the spill, it was originally told it was a different chemical. Oh, so they lied on what chemical, too. How nice is that? Then the 4-methylcyclohexane methanol that spilled into water. But even when the company found out what the chemical was, it couldn't answer many questions about it. This is not a chemical that's typical to be in water treatment processes, McIntyre said during the press conference. Reform mass surveillance. Almost exactly 2 years after the national protest defeated the so-called Stop Online Privacy Act, SOPA, and 1 year after information activist Aaron Swartz took his own life, Washington again is in the midst of another fight about democratic freedoms, the free flow of information, civil liberties, and limits on governmental power. In this debate about reforming National Security Administration, the Beltway is, in typical fashion, busily talking primarily to itself, as if no one else matters. Dominating the conversation are loyal NSA defenders who are now ramping up their efforts to shield the agency from any accountability whatsoever. Meanwhile, there are signs that White House officials are hostile to the most minimum reform proposals, even ones that come from its own NSA panel. How you, an internet user, can help. Visit www.thedaywefightback.com. thedaywefightback.com. Sign up and indicate you'll participate and receive updates. Sign up and install widgets on websites encouraging its visitors to fight back against surveillance. Use social media tools on your site to pronounce your participation. Develop memes, tools, websites, and do whatever else you can to participate and encourage others to do so. At a hermetically sealed D.C. echo chamber, the public is left out of anti-democratic policies being made in its name. This is what led up to the explosive SOPA protests. And if key players in the anti-SOPA coalition are successful, it will now be the story of early 2014. With a hard-hitting new film about Swartz set to be released at Sundance Film Festival this week, and with tech firms suddenly scrambling to recast themselves as critics. They're critics now. They're critics of mass spying. That would be Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and others. Those anti-SOPA activists this morning announced a major grassroots mobilization against the NSA surveillance on February 11th. Write it down, February 11th. The day we fight back. Rove says, Christie's Bridgegate makes Christie only more presidential, and we know that Rove is an unimpeachable source. I would choke on Shakespeare's line. Republican strategist Karl Rove asserted on Sunday news shows that the New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's handling of the George Washington Bridge scandal showed that he has the right qualities to be president of the United States. Oh, I know. He's a bully and doesn't know what's going on. Hey, it worked for Reagan. During a panel segment on Fox News, host John Roberts pointed out that many Republicans were praising Christie for firing one of his top aides after a newspaper exposed his administration's role in closing part of the biggest bridge, the busiest bridge in the world, as part of a political retribution plot for a faux traffic study. Hey, but President Barack Obama has not fired anyone over the health care reform law. Fast track for TPP is filed. We've been waiting for it. We knew it was coming. Fast track for TPP is now in Congress. Baucus has assured us, though, that everything's okay. Framers of the Constitution were wise to include Congress in the process of framing and approving trade agreements made by presidents. That authority to provide advice and consent should, the wisest legislators have always argued, be zealously guarded. Unfortunately, in recent decades, Congress has frequently surrendered its authority when it comes to shaping of trade agreements. By granting so-called fast-track authority to the White House, Congress opts out of the process at a critical stage when an agreement is being struck and retains only the ability to say yes or no to a done deal. The result has been a framing of U.S. trade agreements that is great for multinational corporations but lousy for workers, communities, and the environment. Instead of benefiting the great mass of people in the United States and countries which it trades, deals such as the North American Free Trade Agreement and the Permanent Normalization of Trade Relations Agreement with China de-emphasize worker rights, gut human rights, gut environmental rights, and democratic concerns and clear the way for a race to the bottom. Candidate Barack Obama recognized this in 2008. He told Pennsylvania labor activists, the current fast-track process does not mandate that agreements include binding labor and environmental protections, nor does it give an adequate role to Congress in the selection and design of agreements. I will work with congressional leaders to ensure that any new TPA authority fixes these basic failings and open up the process to the American people for their participation and scrutiny. You may now feel free to contrast that with the secret agreement and secret arrangements made on the TPP, where the public isn't welcome, where Congress itself isn't even welcome to read the stuff. That reference to opening up the process to the American people is key. When members of the House and Senate are engaged with the negotiation process, they can bring concerns of citizens, not just those of corporations with powerful lobbyists and connections, to the fore. That's how representative democracy is supposed to work. And this is especially vital when it comes to debates about economic policy. Now, however, President Obama is seeking fast-tracked authority that activists and trade specialists say does not guarantee that sort of congressional oversight at all. It does not allow for citizen involvement that candidate Obama recognized was essential. And on Thursday, Obama's choice to become the U.S. ambassador to China, Senate Finance Committee, the insurance for the public is off the table, Chairman Max Baucus, joined with the House Ways and Means Committee Chair, Dave Camp, Republican of Michigan. Hey, imagine that. A pseudo-Democrat like Baucus joined with Dave Camp, Republican of Michigan, to introduce legislation to clear the way for the president and his aides to negotiate sweeping new trade deals such as the controversial TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, look it up, with limited congressional oversight. They get to vote yes or no. They get to vote yes or no. Yes or no, sir. For nearly 4 years, U.S. trade representatives and TPP negotiators have purposely restricted participation and information, allowing 600 members of the lobbying community and corporations and zero members of the public, zero members of trade activists, zero members of Congress and citizen groups to participate. There's been no opportunity for public interest groups to meaningfully participate in this negotiation, and under Fast Track, there'll be no opportunity for our elected representatives to amend the deal and make it better for America. Who would have guessed? Fox News expose. Gabriel Sherman's new book on Roger Ailes called The Loudest Voice in the Room. Hey, he works for Roop. Oh, Rupert Murdoch, no problem. Check it out, the new book by Gabriel Sherman on Roger Ailes, The Loudest Voices in the Room. By the way, Fox News refused to comment on it, refused to make a statement on it. Hey, big shocker there. Fracking, we don't need to worry about no stinking fracking. Pennsylvania has confirmed at least 106 water well contamination cases since 2005 out of more than 5,000 new wells. There were 5 confirmed cases of water well contamination in the first 9 months of 2012, 18 in 2011, 29 in 2010. The Environmental Department said no complete data may be available. A more complete data will be available in several months. Ohio had 37 complaints in 2010, no confirmed water contamination in 2012, 59 complaints in 2012, 2 confirmed contaminations, and 40 complaints for the first 11 months of 2013. I wrote Patrick Murphy an email and asked if he was going to support Fast Track. I also wrote a letter to Senator Democrat Bill Nelson, and here's the response I got from Patrick Murphy. It is exactly the same kind of response I got from Nelson, which is to say legislative gobbledygook. Let me read this to you because I know you could use a laugh. As your congressional representative, I am deeply concerned about the impact of unbalanced trade on Florida's economy. Done wrong, trade can cause talented and hardworking employees to lose their jobs. We agree that American workers and farmers should not have to compete with countries like China that pay little or no attention to environmental and labor standards. I've been working to shift the conversation surrounding the TPP negotiations toward leveling the playing field for American workers and address currency manipulation. I strongly believe that American workers can compete against workers across the globe as long as the competition is fair. America boasts the most educated and productive workforce with an innovative and entrepreneurial spirit unmatched worldwide. Done right, trade ought to mean exporting U.S. products, not U.S. jobs. In order for the millions of small business owners across the country to compete in the global economy, our trade policy should promote the ingenuity and superior craftsmanship of American businesses, large and small. That's why I support legislation to promote American manufacturing and infrastructure development. In fact, the first bill I introduced as a member of Congress should boost small business manufacturing capability by promoting the use of clean, high-tech, and efficient processes. I continue to believe that free trade that is fair will mean more jobs for Americans, and I will continue to fight efforts to ship jobs overseas. So I wrote him again and said, hey, that's all well and good. You know, I'm for motherhood. I'm for apple pie. You know, why not? But how you gonna vote? That's what I asked. And, of course, I got the same kind of non-answer answer from our good friend, the Democratic Senator, Mr. Bill Nelson. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, I think our first guests have arrived. So let me bring on the Mrs. Buckner.
To be with you.
Good evening, and how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, and I'll tell you what, I am delighted and impressed to be with some of my favorite people. I don't happen to know Rick Spisak, and I don't happen to know Greg Wilson, or at least I don't know him if I know him. But one of my favorite people in the world, obviously, is my son Michael, and I'm a big fan of Rob Boston and Joe Beck, so you're going to have a great show tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be good. This is Michael Buckner, and I'm happy to be with you.
Glad you gentlemen could join us. You know, I've been reading your book, In Freedom We Trust, and I think you make some really interesting arguments. And as a practicing polytheist / atheist myself, I have a lot of sympathy for your position. But I wondered first if we could define some terms for the audience out there who has maybe a general sense of what atheism might be, and maybe a slightly more ambiguous sense of the argument about this being a Christian nation. So let's take one at a time. And by the way, gentlemen, welcome. I think it was a wonderful book, and I really do urge everyone to read it. It's In Freedom We Trust. And on our text site where we list all the subjects we cover on the show, that's averyvoice.blogspot.com or averyvoice.com, there is a link to buy your book. So, again, I recommend it. It's a wonderful book. So, gentlemen, tell me, what is atheism?
Well, first, let me say I'm delighted to hear that you're trying to help sell our book, and we're eager to have people buy the book. If you don't want to buy it, go to a library. It's in lots of libraries, and if they don't have it, ask for it. We're more interested in having people read the book than anything else. How about, Michael, I'll talk about what atheism is, and you talk about, you know, why this is such a Christian nation.
Right, okay.
And that we worked together on this book. He did more chapters than, or I did more chapters than he did, and some chapters we worked on together. But in any case, we both could answer whatever questions you wanted to throw at us, would be my guess. An atheist is just somebody who doesn't have a belief in anything supernatural. And that doesn't tell you a whole lot else about the person who is an atheist. This book is not an explanation of nor a promotion of atheism. I'm an atheist. I promote it very strongly and often do and like to. But the purpose of the book is to promote secularism. But atheists are not necessarily anti-God. We don't believe there is a God to be anti to. We are people who don't have any supernatural beliefs. That's really all that means. Some atheists are far more militant than others. Some are far less aggressive. Joe Beck is one of the not-so-aggressive ones, but I think he would probably use the word atheist. People like me are pretty well more or less on the assertive side of the atheist dialogue. But none of us, none that I know of, are actually trying to wipe out churches or eat babies or keep there from being a church on every corner or any of that sort of thing. Now, Michael, tell them why this is...
Yeah. There is one superficial sense in which this is a Christian nation, which is that the majority of Americans still profess some form of Christianity, although even that is declining fairly sharply in recent years with the rise of the nuns, the none of the aboves. But this is not and should not be a Christian nation in the sense of Christianity having some official status, of Christianity or any form of Christianity being promoted by the government. This is not a Christian nation in the sense that our laws are founded on Christianity or the Bible or the Ten Commandments. Those are all things that are often claimed, but they're simply not true.
Right.
Okay. Maybe you could address...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, why don't you go ahead, let's go over and have... I'd like to have you explain secularism per se, because we got a decent definition of atheism. Let's go with secularism, then we'll get into why this isn't a Christian nation, because there's obviously a lot of ground to cover there.
Yeah.
So
well,
secularism.
I would say, secularism, I mean, it has various meanings, but the meaning that we're using is the idea that the government should be secular, which is to say neutral, that the government should be concentrating on things in the here and now, whether that's, you know, the army and police and courts and the sort of the things that even libertarians want, or whether it's health care and public education and things that progressives want, but a secular government should not be trying to save your soul if you have a soul. There is also a more sweeping notion of a secularist society, which is a society where even if people are religious, they do keep it more or less to themselves, where the society as a whole is secular. And to be honest, our society is pretty secularized as it is, regardless of anything atheists have done. I mean, most Americans, they worry about their jobs and their families and their, you know, their car payments. So, and we don't even want to drive religion out of the public square, which is a claim that's often made. We're not saying that Christians don't have a right to speak their minds in public so long as they're not trying to claim the support of the government. On the other hand, if you're going to bring things into the public square, you cannot expect those ideas to be immune from criticism. If Christians are going to promote their ideas in the public square, which they have every right to do, they have to understand that there are going to be pesky atheists who are going to be poking holes in their sacred beliefs. And, of course, that the same goes for, you know, that Muslims or Hindus or Buddhists or any other religion. Again, they have every right to speak up, to promote their beliefs, and they have every right to have their speech, their rights protected by the government. They don't have a right to expect themselves to be immune from criticism, and they certainly don't have any right to shut down anybody else's free speech.
It really comes down to no special rights for theists.
Yes.
I'll go with that. That makes sense to me. Ed, let me ask you a question, if I may.
Sure.
Our country has most famously in its founding documents references to freedom of religion. And,
right.
You know, many of our atheist and humanist friends say, well, that allows us also to have freedom from religion. But does the atheist have equal standing in our Constitution to the theist?
We do, and we do because the First Amendment, the 14th Amendment, which are the two key ones, as well as the fact that in Article 6 makes it clear that there shall be no religious test to hold public office under the United States. But in the First and 14th Amendment, the basic message is U.S. citizens get to make decisions about religion without any help or hindrance from the government. This is a matter of religious liberty. This is a matter of limiting government. It's not a matter of limiting individuals. And it is true no matter what your religious beliefs are, or irreligious beliefs, or lack of religious beliefs. And there's no reason to believe that it would be otherwise. Some of the founding fathers, Jefferson and Washington and others, spoke very specifically and positively about atheists. Some of them may have been atheists, but most of them probably were not. Doesn't matter. What they established was a government, a national government, and all of the creatures of that national government, which, thanks to the 14th Amendment, it's very clear that that means all of the state governments, county, city, those governments all are restricted from making religious decisions for individuals. They cannot favor religion or irreligion. And the Supreme Court has decided, interpreted the First and 14th Amendments that way. But actually, you don't even need a Supreme Court to interpret. If you just read them, it's very clear that the First Amendment is limiting government.
Let me make one technical comment. One of you is breathing very closely into the microphone. You might want to back off the microphone just a bit. Okay,
he wants
ahead.
Us to stop breathing, Michael. I don't
terrible.
Know.
No, just don't breathe on the mic.
Okay. I would also say, I mean, I've even seen this very recently, this argument made that, freedom of religion, and that just applies to Christianity. It just means the different sects of Christianity should be free, but it doesn't apply to anybody else like atheists or Muslims. If the framers of the Constitution had wanted to do that, they certainly were perfectly capable of writing language that would have said that explicitly. I mean, there was the Maryland Act of Toleration in colonial times explicitly said that, you know, there was toleration for all Christians, all Protestants, and even Catholics, but that, you know, anybody who didn't accept the Trinity was to be put to death. So the Constitution simply says there should be no law respecting an establishment of religion or abridging the free exercise thereof. If they wanted to say only for Christians, then they should have said only for Christians, but they didn't. The language applies to everyone, and the various of the founding fathers made more extended statements in letters and other documents where they made it very clear that it applies to infidels and Hindus and Mohammedans even.
And the documents that we're talking about, the Constitution, the amended Constitution, don't say anything pro-atheist, but they don't say anything pro-Christian either. And it's been argued about since the time of the ratification fight for the Constitution. There were attempts, even during the writing of the Constitution, to put some good old religion in there, and those attempts failed. And the ones who wanted it ratified had arguments against them. Well, now this document doesn't say anything about this being a Christian nation. That's a big mistake. I'm paraphrasing just a touch, but and the Florida League of the South or whatever the heck it was, the people who came and protested against us at the county where we put up the Ten Commandments anti-Ten Commandments monument. Those folks say with some justification, hey, the U.S. Constitution doesn't recognize our good Christian religion. And then they go on to say we should secede, which, of course, we don't agree with. But this is a fight that's been going on since before the establishment of the United States. And our side has won at every turn. And their writings and documents. Go ahead.
Let me ask you this question. I'm sure you know that atheists, humanists, et cetera, had a profound victory in Tallahassee this past holiday season, when after the typical Christian displays in the Capitol, a Festivus pole was erected to the ironic enjoyment of for many of us. But let me ask you this: typically an author is asked why this book, who is the audience for this book, and what purpose did you write this book? Who were you speaking to?
Well, first of all, you have to understand this is a book that between us we probably worked on for, 10 or 15 years, but we weren't writing a book at the beginning of that process. We were mostly writing letters to the editor, arguing with people at work, trying to counter...
On the Internet.
Or on the Internet, trying to counter the absurd notions that this is a Christian nation, etc. And out of that grew much collecting, filing of data, looking up quotations and that sort of thing. And then finally it got organized into a book. The focus and the audience, the purpose, is to make the case for secularism, to make the case to Americans that the one way in which we really are an exceptional nation is that we are a nation that protects religious liberty by keeping government from making religious decisions for her citizens. So it's aimed at anybody who doesn't understand that already, or at anybody who understands that but wants to have some support when they write their letter to the editor or have their argument on a blog or at the water cooler. It's intended to be a very well-documented, carefully argued, detailed account. It's probably not going to get, the fictional bestseller award or something. I think it's well-written. Well, I'm not exactly objective about these things. I think it's well-written and readable, but it's intended to be persuasive. And persuasive both by logic and by details of history and that sort of thing. And we tried to address the many, many hundreds of different details and arguments that both of us have heard over the last 20 or 30 years. So its audience is intended to be much broader than atheist. It's, the first scholarly paper that was written on this was a scholarly paper written by a middle schooler in Texas, my grandniece. She's 15 at the time. We sent her a copy of the book, and she either asked for or was assigned a paper on, is this a Christian nation? She made it clear she is, at least nominally, a Christian believer. But she made it clear in her paper, citing us quite a few times, I'm happy to say, that this is not a Christian nation, and that's not designed to keep Christians from believing or worshiping as they wish. We think they're wrong about their religion, but we don't think they're right to have and to say and believe what they say and believe should be restricted. Of course it shouldn't. Anyway, she got an A on her paper, and her teacher asked, where'd you get that book? Oh, and she said, the author sent it to us. Sent it to me.
Yeah. Okay, the subtitle of the book is An Atheist Guide to Religious Liberty, but what we really mean by that is that we're openly atheists. We're not trying to hide that or anything, and we're certainly going to present an atheist perspective, but it doesn't mean that that no one else, the people who are not atheists, won't find things of value in this book.
Yeah, we hope, in fact, it's actually aimed more at non-atheists than it is at atheists, but some of both.
Oh, let me ask another question. For those of us who are familiar with the long and checkered history of America's interactions with the Middle East, so-called, many of us are aware of that wonderful treaty that was granted by Jefferson to the nation we now call Libya. Why don't you go ahead and talk about the parallels that you drew between those, the charges that Jefferson faced about his irreligiosity and Obama?
Well, those are two things that are entangled together, and I can talk about both of them.
Any way you like. Go ahead.
Into the famous treaty with Tripoli that is quoted on the monument in, is it Bartow County? Is that the name of the county? Or Bradford County, Florida, has a fine bench with inscribed on it some wonderful Supreme Court things and words from the treaty with Tripoli. That treaty was actually not under Jefferson's watch. It was actually agreed to when George Washington was still president on November the 4th, 1796. But Washington soon left office. It took a long time to get it across the ocean and finally to the U.S. Senate, by which point John Adams was the president. He sent it to the Senate. It was translated into English, and all the senators had a copy, and unanimously, every single senator in a recorded vote, the unanimous recorded votes are fairly rare, but this one was one of the first that happened, and every senator voted in favor of a treaty. Article 11 of that treaty said, as the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, and it goes on to reassure the Bey and people of Tripoli, which is more or less what we call Libya now, the city-state, we're not going to go to war based on religion. So quit messing around with this. The treaty was not very successful. It did not stop the piracy and the impressing of the sailors. And, in fact, Jefferson did come along a bit later, not too much later, and built up a U.S. Navy and went to war. And the Marine hymn that starts out or has in it, from the shores of Tripoli, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, refers to the war that came after the treaty with Tripoli. The next treaty didn't say anything about Christian nation because it didn't need to. We'd already said it, and it didn't take it back. The point of that, the important thing about that, is we agreed to a treaty. It was printed in the papers of the day. It was unanimously accepted in the U.S. Senate, and a treaty that, I don't know, I can't imagine Newt Gingrich getting anywhere agreeing to such a treaty now. But the senators who voted for it were, to a man, and they were, of course, all men, but to a man, they were either reelected. A senator from Georgia became the governor of Georgia after that, and one of them became the Speaker of the House later. So these people they didn't pay some terrible political price for supporting a treaty that said, this isn't a Christian nation. And this was just about, I don't know, 11 years after the Constitution was ratified, and just after George Washington had been president. There have been a few times when atheists have credited George Washington with saying that, and he didn't. It was passed under his administration. There's every reason to believe he would have agreed with it, but in fact he did not say the words that are in the treaty. The parallel between, there are a number of parallels, but when Jefferson ran in 1800 for president, there were things in the newspaper that said, you got to choose between God and Jefferson because, you know, he's an atheist, and he almost certainly was not an atheist. He was a deist or a Unitarian, more likely. But the political upheaval over whether he's a good Christian and all that sort of thing parallels what's happened to Obama. He was also accused of being a pacifist and turned out to be fairly warlike if he needed to be.
Also like Obama.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think he killed off an Osama bin Laden on his watch, Jefferson, but he did, in fact, execute a war against some Muslim terrorists. That's really what they were. So there are a number of parallels, and throughout our history, not just Jefferson, but all sorts of parallels. And people don't understand that this argument's been going on all along. It used to be the Republicans were on the correct side of this. You get people like Grant and other presidents who said we should tax churches and we should keep church and state forever separate, and the divorce between church and state should be absolute. No public funds should ever be used to support sectarian education. So, yeah, the history of this is, it's longstanding. There was a a fairly serious effort around the end of the 1800s, 19th century, to amend the Constitution of the United States and change it so it would say, in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, that effort failed. It was actually introduced into the Congress more than once, but it never got voted out. The effort failed, and it failed because most Americans then, and I hope most Americans now, understood it's in their best interest to keep government out of religious decision-making. Michael, you want to add anything to that?
No, I don't think so. That was okay. A good summation.
So we've got Obama being accused of being a secret Muslim, and Jefferson was accused of not being religious enough. Now, Jefferson's erudition on the topic of Christianity was quite extensive. He had left, if you will, quite a paper trail. He wrote his own Bible, didn't he?
Well, he spoke and wrote a number of different languages, and he took, I think it was 7 different Bibles and cut and pasted. This was a private project, at least at the beginning. And he took out all of the parts of the Bible that referred to miracles or anything no Jesus doing amazing,
supernatural stuff,
unbelievable.
I think it was not even the New Testament, but the Gospels specifically.
Yeah, I think
and for you young whippersnappers, when we say cut and paste, we mean he actually got scissors and paste, you know, and was cutting out in the.
Yeah, and he was doing that quite literally. I don't think it got published during his lifetime, but later it did. It's called Jefferson's Bible. It's readily available in bookstores and libraries, and I've got a copy. It makes it clear he believed that Jesus was a great teacher, that he was an actual human being, a historical figure, something I don't really agree with Jefferson about, but he believed that. But he didn't believe that he was the Son of God. Jefferson actually said that Jesus said that he was a deist and not a believer that Jesus was the Son of God. Now, I don't know whether Jefferson's right about that or not. It doesn't really matter.
Jefferson also at one point talked about how, of course, Jesus made mistakes. You know, there were things that he did not agree about with Jesus on. Jefferson was not an atheist, but he wasn't really, despite his admiration of Jesus, he was not a Christian in the sense that the vast majority of Christians mean it. He didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God, he didn't believe that Jesus saved the world by being sacrificed and resurrected. He specifically said he didn't believe in the resurrection.
He went further than that, and I've had Christians quote me this letter that Jefferson wrote in which he said he was, I don't know if it was a real Christian or a true Christian, I forget which word it was, but in that letter he makes it clear, I'm a true Christian or a real Christian because I think Jesus was a great teacher and so forth, but I don't believe in the resurrection, I don't believe in atonement, vicarious atonement, I don't believe in, he lists about 15 things that an Orthodox Christian would believe. And he obviously did not mean when he said he was a real Christian that he thought Jesus died for your sins, because he did not believe that.
On page 84, on page 84 of your book, if you have one handy, you list Jefferson's rejections in that letter to William Short. So if you want to refer to that, I thought I would bring that to your attention in case the subject came up.
Yeah, you should know that William Short was his secretary, a person of great importance to him, administrative assistant might be a better term, at least it's a term we'd use these days, but what's important about it doesn't really matter what Jefferson believed. What matters is what the Constitution says, but these idiots who claim that Thomas Jefferson is one of them and is a fundamentalist Christian, they genuinely don't know anything about history. They don't know anything about, like you said, there's actually a couple of different letters that he wrote to Short in April of 1820. He said, I'm a materialist, and he takes the side of spiritualism. He preaches the efficacy of repentance toward forgiveness of sin, and I require a counterpoise of good works. But in another letter, he goes on into some detail about the specific things that he rejects. Aside from those things there. So And as I say, what matters is not what Jefferson believed, but what the Constitution requires.
Yeah, I mean, the point is not that we should all be good deists like Thomas Jefferson. I mean, the founding fathers, a lot of them were deists. It was a, you know, very much the religion that was in vogue among the enlightened and upper class people. But the point is that perhaps because they did have beliefs that were unorthodox, they established a government that would protect the rights of deists, of Christians, of atheists, of everyone. And they even spoke rather theoretically about Muslims and Hindus, that they would also be protected, although there probably weren't very many of those in the United States at that time.
But they were, it was enough presence that they were actually mentioned in some of these letters,
yeah,
and quotes and so forth. And George Washington wrote to somebody else that he wanted him to send him some workers, that he needed some good workers, but he wanted people who knew what they were doing and were skilled, and he didn't care whether they were atheists or Hindus or Jews or whatever. But they got to be people of good character. Well, now, the fact that they do have to be people of good character means, obviously, he didn't think you had to be a Christian to be a person of good character.
You have another argument that I think is very interesting in terms of contemporary politics. You talk about Newt Gingrich's extensive contributions to incivility.
Yep.
Why don't you talk a little bit about why you included this section on Newt Gingrich?
Well, he is, and pardon me, Newt, I've formally requested that you debate me, and I'm still willing to do so. So before you decide to sue me for slander, let's get into a debate. What do you say? Newt is a demagogue. He is somebody who is perfectly willing to lie and make stuff up if it makes him look good. He's written a number of books and, of course, has given dozens of talks as well as run for president. I guess he's given hundreds of talks. And he just makes stuff up. And he does make stuff up about very specific things. For example, he made up stuff about whether prayers were issued at the Constitutional Convention. And he just bald-faced lies, things that he supposedly is a historian. There's just no way he doesn't know that these things are false. So he gets his own chapter, and it's an honor which I think probably plenty of other politicians wish they could have.
He also wrote a pretty infamous memo,
right.
Language, a Key Mechanism of Control, which is just a great title right there. I mean, sounds like straight out of Orwell, in which he basically said that Republicans should make a point of using words like destructive and hypocrite and failure and of course socialist and all those words that they love to throw around, that rather than trying to have reasoned arguments, they should just use every kind of denigrating word in the book to paint their opponents as bad people. Now, of course, he didn't invent this, but I think he bears a lot of responsibility for creating the current climate of severe polarization where people can't, there's no more compromise and no more of that, you know, working across the aisles and bipartisanship. It's just war to the knife, and also this climate of just hurling invective at people instead of actually criticizing their ideas, just saying, that's socialism, without even defining socialism
And it's important, the reason he makes it into the book is not just that he is a purveyor of incivility, but that he was and has been and still is a purveyor of incivility in the service of the false notion that this is a Christian nation, that atheists are unacceptable. I mean, he said in one of his presidential debates or forums, that if you didn't believe in God, no one should possibly trust you. I'm paraphrasing. I think the quote's actually in our book, but I don't have that particular quote in front of me. But he is a fine example of what a political leader should not be, and that's not because he's not an atheist. If he were an atheist and he was this much of a demagogue kind of person who urges people to be attack dogs rather than thoughtful dialogue people, he'd still deserve most of the criticism that we lay down on him.
I can only imagine that when you watched, as I did, the Republican primary last time around, and we heard Republican candidate after Republican candidate after Republican candidate denounce evolution, deny that they ever supported evolution, I think that bodes terribly, terribly badly for this
too.
Country.
Yeah, I agree, and that is not a primary focus of our book, of defending evolution. It has been more of a focus of my life in some ways than other things have been. But in this book, we do make it very clear in the chapter on secular schools and so forth that religious ideas, anybody who thinks intelligent design or creationism isn't a religious idea, has not paid attention, has not read the wonderful opinion issued by the judge up in Pennsylvania, Republican appointee, Kitzmiller.
And I'm sure a Christian as well.
Probably so, yeah. And he made it very clear that those creationist and intelligent design pushers, they're pushing a religion. And they have a right to press the religion, but they don't have the right to do it in the public school classrooms or to use the support of public or government officials to encourage these kinds of religious beliefs. Scientific beliefs need to be decided by scientists and by peer-reviewed journals and that sort of thing, and not by the kind of demagoguery that you see in the service.
And decided by actual evidence, not by, faith or scripture. And I think there's also a larger attack on science and even the idea of expertise, of people having knowledge about things because they've spent years studying them. That's very unfortunate. I mean, there's also, the issue of climate change and global warming or vaccination, which is not all by any means from the right, unfortunately.
Right. Agreed.
I had the good fortune to arrange a series of debates during the USA Patriot Act period, and one of the debates was a creationism versus evolution debate, and we invited religious educators from the local seminary to discuss this matter in a civil fashion with a microbiologist and a biochemist. And if I can boil out their argument to a simple few lines, their argument was, well, once Darwin came along and invented homosexuality, it was downhill from there on. So they rejected any science. They rejected any science after 1850. And the imp in me wanted to ask them if they brought their carriage or did they go saddleless coming here to the auditorium. And clearly they don't use those modern devil's tools like television and radio and phones. But
preachers love television.
Yeah. Or the advances in medicine that are possible only with an understanding of biological evolution should all be denied to those people. It's absurd.
Well, to end on a positive note, and I think that your book is full of lots of positive things, I'd like you both to talk a little bit about tolerance and the importance of tolerance in civilization. Let me start with Michael this time.
Okay. One point we make in the book is the distinction between tolerance and toleration, with toleration being this old idea that the government, the king or the state or whatever should tolerate religious minorities. That is just sort of, even though we have the truth on our side, we're going to put up with you people, and we don't want that. We don't want toleration. We want equal religious liberty, equal freedom for everyone, Christians, atheists, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, and everyone in between. But on an individual level, we do need tolerance. We do need a willingness to accept that, yes, I don't agree with that guy down the street, but I'm not going to wage holy war on him. He may be a good guy just in the sphere of being a fellow citizen.
Ed?
Well, I think Michael has said it pretty well. One thing people should understand is that the whole notion of tolerance and toleration and the distinction between them is an important one, and that it goes back to the beginning of this nation. And this is the part that startles and surprises an awful lot of people. The Baptists were among the leaders of the idea that we should not have tolerance and toleration in this sense, that we should say to the government, you don't get to decide what's orthodox, what's acceptable, and then say it's okay if you disagree with us. You don't get a vote. You're not involved. And many Baptists believe that John Leland and other Baptist leaders of the day, Isaac Backus, were instrumental in bringing about the First Amendment and Madison's ideas in the Constitution. I think maybe the Baptists overclaim credit for some of that, but I think they do get some credit. And it still exists in the documents that you can find in, you know, the Baptist Faith and Message Call or whatever it's called, actually has a section in it that says church and state should be separate, that the church should not expect the state to do its business for it and all that kind of stuff. I don't think
gentlemen,
average Southern Baptist in Florida pays much attention to that.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I want to mention again your book, In Freedom We Trust. It's an excellent book. It's a thoughtful read. Measured argument. Gentlemen, I think you've achieved something very important in it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us. And good luck to you and Rob Boston.
Yes, indeed. Also a very good writer and speaker.
Okay, and of course these shows are posted once they're over live, and you'll be able to have for your friends or listeners tune in any time for the next week, and they'll be the first show on the list. So make sure you tell people tune in, and thanks again for joining us.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New
Year. And Happy New Year, too. A sectarian intolerant one, please.
Yeah, please.
Okay, thanks so much.
Take care.
Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring on our next guest, Mr. Rob Boston. And Rob is the Communications Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you for having me on.
You are involved in such an important institution. Could you tell us a little bit about the Americans United for Separation of Church and State?
Yes, sure. Americans United is a group that is multi-faith, multi-philosophy. It includes people from many different religious and non-religious backgrounds. We're nonpartisan. We bring people together strictly on the issue of supporting the concept of separation of church and state. And we focus exclusively on that issue. We believe that there's so many things are sort of revolving around that basic right that it needs a full-time defense from an organization on the national level, and that's the role we play.
When the term culture war is bandied about by some like a sword and some like a shield, This lack of tolerance, to me, is a real blight on civilization. To you, as a person involved in this arena, how important is tolerance to our civilization?
I think it's very important. I think it's the first step on a longer journey, however. Toleration is, as I say, something that we need to be looking at as a step, but it leads to other things. Religious liberty in this country, for example, if you look at the history, the experience in the colonies, whether it was not much tolerance, whether it was a lot of intolerance, tolerance sort of opened the door toward a broader understanding of religious liberty for everybody. And then eventually that right being extended to those who had no belief and the concept of it not just being something that you would have toleration within the Christian denominations, but in fact you would have that tolerance extended to non-Christian denominations and indeed non-believers. So it's an extremely important concept, and one, unfortunately, as you point out, that sometimes seems to be in short supply in this country.
Whenever we have a major holiday for one of the denominations in this country, the news is full of it. Obviously, commercial promotion is a big part of this. But it seems like the cultural war drums are beat again and again. We just had Ed and Michael Buchner on talking about their book, In Freedom We Trust, which is kind of a why atheism and tolerance is so important. It seems to me that the rhetoric has gotten more and more heated when, in fact, we clearly have a more multicultural nation.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. And in fact, I think it's that multicultural nation that's causing the rhetoric. There's a pushback to that. If you think about the changes that this country has undergone in the past 40 or 50 years, they're really quite remarkable. You had the rise, first of all, of the civil rights movement, then the rise of the women's rights movement, rise of the gay rights movement. And now you're seeing the rise of a non-believer movement seeking their rights. And for some people who hold to fundamentalist or extremely conservative Christian views, these changes have just been too much too fast. So they're reacting to that. One of the things I do at Americans United is I kind of track religious right organizations, and I do that by looking at their publications and, you know, visiting their websites.
You must stay busy.
But also going, yeah, exactly. Well, and going to their meetings, too. That's actually an important part of it. When you actually go to the meetings and you're in the crowd, surrounded by thousands of people who believe in this view of the religious right, listening to the speakers and hearing the exchange of information and ideas, you get a little bit of, I think, a better understanding about what's motivating these folks. They really do believe that the America that they grew up with is at risk, and it's slipping away from them. Now, in a sense, they're right. It's changed. And most of us look at that change and say, well, that's for the good. You know, we no longer have racist policies in the government, or at least we're trying to eradicate them. Women are taking their rightful place in society, and now we're seeing same-sex marriage being legalized in many states. But some people are very threatened by these things. And their answer is to embrace this extremely conservative version of Christianity and attempt to merge it with the government and actually expect the government to enforce its theological dictates. And that's where we start running into problems.
Well, many of us have heard the terrible stories about the problems at the Air Force Academy, where, if you will, a Christian clique has basically gained control of the levers of authority.
Yes, that's a good example. For a long time, there was this sort of just understanding that the Air Force Academy had this sort of Christian view about it, a conservative one, again, a fundamentalist one. They were promoting that. There was not a good bit of tolerance. There were examples of members of other faiths feeling that their rights were not being respected. They spoke up. And you may know Mikey Weinstein, who now runs
Sure.
a group that works on that issue full-time. But Mikey first came to our organization, Americans United, to ask for help. And we helped him. We did what we could. But at some point, both of us realized, I think, Mikey and myself, that a full-time organization was going to be needed to work on that issue because the scope of it was just enormous. And he really has done great work in that area, but there's so much more to be done. Again, this is an example of that kind of old-style thinking that some folks had, that these government institutions, in this case a branch of the military, deserve to be, you know, Christianized and belong to this specific viewpoint. And they were not happy about letting that go, but they must. They had to, and we're still working on those issues.
When I mentioned to the Buckners, when you watch the, let's say, for example, the Republican primary debates, where we see every candidate denouncing evolution, it just seems to me that the only logical conclusion is that these people believe, these candidates, these political figures believe, that unless they snuggle up to the religious right, there's no place for them in the American political scheme.
Yes, that does seem to be the case. Now, having looked at this situation for a number of years, because I've worked at Americans United for 26 years, so I've watched this for a while, I've come to the conclusion that basically you have people in one of two camps. One camp would be the kind of people you're talking about who just pander, who may not believe this, but they feel that they have to present these views, they have to adopt these extreme social conservative views in order to be viable, especially on the national stage. So that's one camp. The second camp are the true believers, the people who really do believe it and who accept all this, and it forms their worldview. And you could get into an argument about which is worse. I mean, to me, there's a lot of problems there. But clearly we're in a point where we have large-scale refusal to accept modern science. There was a poll just out recently from the Pew Forum about Americans' acceptance of evolution. And, you know, it hits about 60%, which isn't bad, but it's actually kind of embarrassing if you think about this being, you know, the year 2014. But the interesting thing about that poll was that it showed acceptance of evolution among Republicans had actually dropped by a few points. As that party becomes more conservative and more religious, more fundamentalist, you're actually seeing larger numbers rejecting a tenet of modern science.
When that's one of the things that makes me just either amazed at the hypocrisy or troubled by the state of American education, that kind of position, that kind of mental furniture, if you will, is leading a significant portion of the country. When, in fact, we've got demographics that are doing something completely different, that if you say we need to compete in the world of ideas and the world of science, these things are clearly at odds.
Yes, and one thing I've noticed about the extreme right, especially the religious right, is that they are data-proof. In other words, no amount – well, it's true. No amount of contrary information can move the needle in most cases. I can give you another example of that we've been looking at here, around the country, is this plan to shift education from the public sector to the private sector. And that's a very aggressive movement, and a lot of the schools benefiting from that are religious institutions. So there are fundamentalist academies or Catholic schools, and there's an attempt to give them tax money. Now, there have been several studies of this plan in many states where it's being used, and they're not showing any improvement academically. But the ideologues cling to it. They don't care what the studies say. They don't care what the data says. At a certain point, unfortunately, in this country, ideology trumps all the data, and that's where we are right now.
Well, okay, let me ask you a question. I want to take benefit of your experience in the arc of history that you've been watching. What year or when did you get involved first in this organization?
I started late in 1987.
Okay. So as you see this, the evolution of this dialogue between the tolerant third, the intolerant 20%, 30%. How do you think of that group of people that are, not accessible to information? How large a segment do you think that is?
I would say it probably is somewhere between 15-20%. But here's the thing about it: it has kind of an outsized voice politically because so many people aren't involved in the process or aren't registered or aren't voting or whatever. I'll say this about the religious right, having observed the movement for a long time. They're very disciplined. They don't miss elections. They show up. They vote in primaries. They vote in general elections. That's commendable. I mean, that behavior on their part. I wish more Americans would follow that point of view.
That's a strange-tasting lemonade, if you ask me.
Yeah, well, you know, that they tend to maybe take their marching orders politically from churches and pastors and that sort of thing, but they're out there. They're getting involved in the process. They are doing, actually, I think, what the left did a lot of in the 1960s with grassroots organizing. Now, having said that, though, I would say that the portion of the demographic that they represent is shrinking. I think all the data shows that. The nation is becoming more diverse racially, and we're having profound changes because of that that are affecting the political system. And they haven't really been able to tailor a message to go beyond a base which is evangelical, overwhelmingly white, and increasingly older. So,
Hold on a second. Rob, isn't it true? I think Mr. Romney had a wonderful message. He said, they'll self-deport.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, this is the sort of thing that it's out of touch with modern reality, and the demographics will speak against it every time. So I don't think the long-term prospects for them look really good if they can't craft some kind of a more broadly based message. And you're seeing that play out politically right now and on many different fronts. And it's kind of hard to tell how that will go. But certainly, look at the issue of same-sex marriage as one example. The polling data is very clear on that. The younger generation just doesn't see it, by and large, doesn't see it as a huge issue. They're not concerned. They support it. Or at least they're not so opposed to it that they're going to base their vote on it. So you're going to find sooner or later that demographic begins to become more prominent, and that will have an impact politically. But the answer to the religious right isn't to, you know, craft a new message. It's to ignore that reality, you know, get even more into the bunker mentality, and just keep pressing forward.
Well, I think we all, those of us again who pay attention, heard that the Republican Party, facing the defeat that they had last time around, did a thorough analysis and decided it wasn't their message was wrong, it was crafted wrong.
Yes, actually, and if you look at some of the things that have happened since then, there's a lot of evidence to indicate that they really just feel that they just need to keep pressing with this thing and moving forward with it. Now, you know, in these midterm elections in 2014, they may actually have some success because of the political landscape tends to favor some of the more conservative states. And if that happens, they're going to say, well, see, we're vindicated. We don't have to change our message. We can win with this message. The question becomes, can they win on a national stage with a message like that, or can they just win in an increasingly smaller number of states that still have a very conservative electorate? That's the problem that they're facing, and that's why I think the long-term prospects for the religious right aren't so great, but certainly their power will continue to give them some victories over the next few years anyway.
Rob, let me ask you another question. One of the themes of tonight's show is that with atheism and humanism or secularism, there are those on the theist side of things that feel that without theism, without some belief in some supernatural being, one cannot have morality. What is your answer to those who say, oh my God, if you're not a theist, you can't be a moral person?
Well, again, I think that the data and evidence clearly shows that that's not true. We can all point to people that we know who don't have a particular religious belief or aren't affiliated or maybe identify as atheist, agnostic, humanist, whatever, and are living good, decent, moral lives. So I really think that I'm hoping that we can get into a position where we can start to forge a coalition, and Americans United has tried to do this and has been successful, where we have religious people working alongside non-religious people toward the common goal of promoting the separation of church and state. We have to understand that this is a principle that protects everybody, whether you're a devout Baptist or a very virulent atheist. It doesn't really matter. It protects both of you and everybody in between.
If there is a person out there who wants to be involved in helping this dialogue along, how can they participate in Americans United?
Well, the easiest way is simply to visit our website, which is au.org, so it's very simple, au.org. And you can get information there about chapters, see if there's one in your area. All of the chapters of Americans United reflect the type of diversity that we've been talking about. You find very religious people, and then you find people who aren't religious at all, but they're working together side by side to promote this idea of separation of church and state. And, you know, I often go out and speak to these chapters, and I joke with them. I say, you know, you guys, you do a great job, you know, defending the separation of church and state. And I know after the meetings, they may go out to, get a coffee or a drink or whatever, and that's when they argue about theology. But when they're representing Americans United, they stick to the message of separation of church and state, tolerance, diversity, and religious liberty, and philosophical liberty for everyone.
Here in Florida, I'm sure you heard about the exciting holiday season controversy when, in response to the typical Christian symbology in the Capitol, we also had a Festivus pole erected.
Yes, I did hear about that.
And I was just wondering if we could get an atheist community to come together and put maybe a clear pane of glass or maybe a mirror.
Well, you know, in some parts of the country, atheist groups have put messages up. There's a group in Wisconsin called the Freedom From Religion Foundation that worked on that issue. And there was one state, I'm trying to remember where it was. It was either Washington or Oregon. It was in the Pacific Northwest, where the displays were allowed outside the Capitol, the state Capitol. And there was a Christian display there sponsored by a Christian group. And I think there was a menorah there a while sponsored by a Jewish group. So the Freedom From Religion's local chapter, they put up some kind of a sign. I don't remember exactly what it said, but it was a sign indicating or including some of their beliefs. So they were included as well. And increasingly, we're seeing not only the Festivus poles, which you mentioned, but also in Florida, if I'm not mistaken, they also had a Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster display, right,
for
a while as well. So, and there's an interesting situation right now unfolding in Oklahoma where there's a Ten Commandments display at the state capitol. And a couple of other groups are coming in and asking to put up their symbols as well. One is a Hindu group who wants to put up a Hindu deity called Lord Hanuman, also known as the monkey god.
Sure.
And then
sure.
A Satanist group has come in, and they want to put up a statue too. So it's getting pretty interesting there. I mean, obviously, from the perspective of someone who advocates for separation of church and state, I would rather that there not be these religious symbols on government property. But if they're going to be there, you have to extend equal treatment to everybody. You can't just put up one and say, well, this is representing all of the community, when in fact it may only represent a certain segment of the community.
Well, Rob, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Is there any final message you might want to leave with our audience?
I'm just going to say this. I'll shamelessly plug a new book that I have coming out in March.
Please do.
It's called Taking Liberties. The subtitle is Why Religious Freedom Doesn't Give You the Right to Tell Other People What to Do, which I think is a very lively issue this country is going through right now, how far religious freedom goes and how far the right goes and what happens when your religious freedom starts to affect somebody else's rights. And I'm trying to give some sensible answers to that in the book. So that'll be out March 4th.
Well, then, you know, I'm going to ask you one more question because I think that raises
sure.
a very, very interesting issue. The discussion I'm going to be very generous and call it a discussion. The issue of access to birth control.
Absolutely.
Period.
Huge part of this.
Whether or not through the employment or not, we see forces across the country wanting to march us back 100 years.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think what's happening here is that is a misuse of the concept of religious liberty. Concept of religious liberty is a noble concept. It's an important concept. It gives you the right to decide when you'll worship, how you'll worship, who you'll worship with, but it gives you no right to impose that on anyone else or take away anybody else's rights. So in this book, one of the things I'm trying to do is lay down some sensible guidelines to resolve controversies like that. Now, the problem, of course, we're running into is that some people don't want to resolve the controversy in any way that's, that breaks in any way that's favorable to them, because their goal isn't so much to protect their own religious freedom. It is to take away somebody else's access to birth control. They are trying to reverse some of those gains that I talked about earlier of modern life that they don't like. And they're using religious liberty, I think, as a sword to strike at others instead of a shield to protect themselves.
You know, the thing that troubles me, when I hear that I'm going to call the crocodile tears of those who are defending, let's say, this nun group from providing birth control for their employees, where is the discussion about the religious rights of those who might choose birth control who happen to be employees? That
yes, exactly.
doesn't
thing,
get
yes,
discussed.
Yes, it's important to remember that these nuns are running a chain of nursing homes. Which, you know, is a secular, largely secular enterprise. Their employees come from many different religious and non-religious backgrounds, and some of them, many of them, want access to this medication, basically, that they have the right to have. Another thing I think that gets overlooked in this debate is that what some of these religious groups are asking for is they're asking the state to enforce a policy that they have been unable to get people to take on voluntarily. If the nuns were doing a better job trying to voluntarily persuade people about birth control, they wouldn't have to have the state come in and be their enforcer. And you find that with a lot of these theological questions. What happens is a religious group is unable to get people to adopt their view, so they ask the state to enforce it for them. And that, to me, is just a complete, I think, corruption of the whole principle of religious liberty.
Well, Rob, thanks again so much. I'm really glad you could join us, and I hope we can get you to come back again sometime, okay?
Absolutely. I look forward to it. Take care.
Thanks again. That's Rob Boston, Communications Director of Americans United. Thank you, Rob. Okay. Before we get on to our next guest, I do want to mention, I want you to tune in to our colleagues on the Progressive Broadcasting Circuits, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Wise Women Media, Anita Stewart Show, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Bigwheel of Sita Media, Harriet Lerman, The Voice of the People, and I'm going to add a new name to our list. Harry Shearer has a wonderful show that if you enjoy politics and humor, you should definitely check out The Harry Shearer Show. Just do a search online. You won't be able to avoid finding it. It's a tremendous show. Unfortunately, it happens to be opposite my dear friend, Gwen Holden Berry, so you have to time shift to listen to that. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to bring you our good friend, Mr. Joe Beck, who is the founder of the Treasure Coast Humanists. And let me bring him on in just a second. Here we go. Joe Beck, founder of the Treasure Coast Humanists. Good afternoon, Joe. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Rick.
Well, good, good. Joe, tonight's show is oriented around the idea that no matter what the society, there is always a set of moral choices in front of it. There's many in front of America right now, and there are those, I think I'm going to characterize them as being theists or believer in some great spirit or godhead with a particular name, who seem to believe that they have the corner on morality, and that if you don't believe in their deity, regardless of where he came from and the time and all that, if you don't believe in their deity or some particular deity, you just can't be a moral being. And I know, Joe, you are a humanist. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what humanism is, and then I'd like you to react to that idea that unless you believe in some other being, you can't have a morality. So, Joe, what is a humanist?
Thanks, Rick. Well, Rick, essentially, if somebody would like a more professional definition of humanism, I'd refer them to a couple of websites. One would be the American Humanist Association website, and the other would be the Council for Secular Humanism website. There you'll get a nice history of humanism and a thorough professional definition. I'd like to keep it simple. Humanism is basically a philosophy of life that encourages people to live a life that is pleasurable for them and that leads to the betterment of society without any concern about supernatural gods, heavens, hells, angels, or an afterlife. So it's basically being good for the sake of being good. And, you know, you had asked earlier, or you had mentioned that very often there's this completely unfounded misconception that somehow there's a relationship between being religious and being a kind or compassionate person. And we know there's no evidence for that whatsoever. There is, however, a lot of evidence that demonstrates that religions have been used to justify the most vicious acts you can possibly think of by institutions, religions, especially when those institutions or religions were somehow in unison with the government. And I guess we could go through some basic examples. We've all heard of the Inquisitions, the Spanish Inquisition and the Roman Inquisition. So we know the Catholic Church in the 1500s was persecuting people, torturing them to death simply for questioning a belief or simply wondering if one of the tenets of the Church was accurate. We've never had anybody that I know of killed in the name of humanism. Now, we have humanists arguing with one another. I've seen people say nasty things about one another or write unkind things about one another, but I'm not aware of anybody ever trying to justify the killing of anybody or the torturing of anybody in the name of humanism. Does that help to set a basis?
Sure, Joe, sure. Now, what I'd like to do is also ask you to think with us for a second. Now, let's say, for example, I'd like to take several of the moral dilemmas that face the country right now and ask you how, with your own, you know, your own individual insight into humanism, how do you go about thinking about these things? And let me give you an example. There are those who are concerned about the homeless and the hungry. And for example, there are people in Congress right now trying to extend unemployment benefits. Now, obviously, we hear from Congress, there's two arguments that they're raising. One is that people need help. They're starving. They don't have a home for their families. And they should be helped. Another, well, a more conservative opinion is that any help provided is a palliative and strictly prolongs and encourages sloth, and people shouldn't be helped because it breeds dependency. How does a humanist look at that dilemma, sir?
Well, let me add, whenever there's a humanist statement, and there have been probably, I think, maybe three or four internationally accepted humanist manifestos that outline the ethics of humanism, the values of humanism. Somewhere along the line, at the bottom of his statement, it says, the undersigned do not necessarily agree with every aspect of what's been written here, but they generally agree with the overall nature of the document. I think a humanist would first say, what are our values? Our values are we try and lead a rational, compassionate life. So let's take rationality, compassion, and look at the fact that here in the United States of America, we are undoubtedly the most powerful nation in the world, and we're a very, very wealthy nation. And if for some reason, even though we produce an overabundance of food in America, some people in America go hungry. And even though we have some of the best medical care in the world, some of the folks have no medical care, no medical insurance, or if they have insurance, it is so minimal that if they get any kind of substantial illness, cancer or any other type of long-term chronic illness, they go bankrupt in less than a year because all their savings are gone. So when that's happening in our country, I think that the typical humanist would say that simply is irrational to think you've got people going hungry and without medical care in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. So what would compassion lead us to do? I think compassion would lead us to ask our politicians to put together policies. Someone suggested that when our politicians develop policies, they do so with the understanding that when they walk into the room, they're walking in as healthy, strong politicians. But that when they left, they might leave that room. If they could just picture themselves leaving that room, being handicapped, sightless, perhaps having a mental issue or a physical issue, somehow unable to take care of themselves and their family, what laws would they like to write that would protect themselves and their family in the event they became unable to work and bring home a paycheck for the family? We think if our politicians were to use some type of a guide like that, they'd be able to come up with a more compassionate way of dealing with people. It's unjustifiable, in my opinion, to cancel or reduce employment benefits for people who've been employed or unemployed long term in a country where we have a high unemployment rate and where we know that our economy simply isn't producing the well-paying jobs that people need. So, to me, the humanist would say, what's a fair, reasonable way of offering help to people who need the help and yet motivating people to continue working or to seek employment? Humanism wouldn't be advocating for handouts. We'd be advocating for helping people to become self-sustaining, recognizing that some folks simply are not going to become self-sustaining right now, and some people on the long term, folks who are significantly developmentally disabled, for example, they're not going to be self-supporting in this type of economy. The humanist, and I think, quote, the good Christian, the good Muslim, the good Jew, the compassionate religious folks, hopefully can also see that we need to put together policies that protect people and yet encourages them to work for themselves to whatever degree possible.
Thank you, Joe. Let me ask you another one of those difficult questions that, again, I think it's important for the audience to hear how a humanist reasons through these things without the benefit of appealing to some invisible being who lives in the sky or in some other dimension. Let's take the problem of drone warfare. Many people find no problem at all in us using drones. These are automatically controlled at a distance bombing systems or weapon systems that can fly over some other nation and kill people who the president or his designees decide needs to be killed. And it doesn't bother them that we're going into these other countries. It doesn't bother them that we go kill these people without any judicial constraints, simply because it doesn't put any of our soldiers at risk. How would a humanist reason through that dilemma, sir?
Well, Rick, again, I'm not an expert on warfare, but again, I think a reasonably compassionate person, whether they're religious or secular, would recognize that whenever we have a bomb or a drone, no matter how sophisticated, it is going to kill completely innocent men, women, and children. Even if it's targeted with the best technology we have today, it's going to result in the killing of innocent men, women, and children. Is that something that we think is justifiable? That to me would be even a larger question. I think every country has a right to defend itself against people who are trying to hurt them. You know, an active terrorist trying to bomb the country, for example. But the idea of using drones, it really bothers me, especially when we so coldly refer to some of the deaths as collateral damage. It's insensitive. And I don't think it makes for a safer society. I don't think it helps America. I think it's irrational to think that we're helping America when we're killing other people's mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts, and children.
Thank you.
It's a bad policy.
Now, let me ask you just one more what I think of as a true, actual moral dilemma for our society. I had invited a guest, and unfortunately he can't join us today, a gentleman named Keith McHenry, who is one of the founders of Food Not Bombs. And this was created originally during the Vietnam era, and their thinking was, if we're going to pull resources together to solve problems internationally or nationally, maybe it might be better if we fed people rather than blew them up as a general policy. So they began working on feeding the homeless, feeding the hungry, and they collect food and they grow food and then they feed the hungry. Unfortunately, many cities don't like the fact that the hungry and the homeless are being gathered together, typically in city parks or in some civic space, and then fed. And specific laws have been passed by Democrats as well as Republicans. In fact, Keith tells me more by Democrats than Republicans, oddly enough, that they've been specifically making laws not just to prohibit feeding the hungry, but providing any care to homeless and hungry people. So how does the humanist look at this dilemma of having starving people in the streets, homeless people in the streets? Is it a legitimate problem that society, who's clearly not fixing it through, we might say, more civic structures, that a group takes on the problem and tries to feed the hungry? How would a humanist look at that dilemma, sir?
Well, Rick, again, you know, the way you present this, it's obviously a heartless policy. I mean, it's simply heartless. It lacks the compassion that any of the organized religions talk about. I can't phrase it any stronger than that. It's a heartless policy. But let me backtrack if I can for a moment, because you had earlier said something, and you know, it was accurate, that most people think that somehow being affiliated with a religion helps to make you moral and ethical. Today's research, and I encourage your readers to research it on their own. I don't want them to take my point of view. But we know that the most religious countries in the world always, they seem to be the most violent. They seem to be the countries where there's the greatest disparity between the rich and the poor. And the country that had the lowest differences between the, let's say, the average worker and the top executives are secular countries. So if anything, if we look at the world today, we're finding that the secular countries are more gentle and more generous than the most religious countries. Why that is, I don't know. I don't think religion has to be cold-hearted. It's just that our politicians use religion to get votes, and whatever good religion can do, I think, is minimized tremendously when we start intertwining it into politics. I urge my religious friends, and most of the people in America claim some type of religion, even if they don't practice it on a regular basis and they may not belong to a specific church or synagogue. They've got some type of feeling that there's a God and that there's some type of religion that they affiliate with in some way. I think we as Americans have to ask our religious leaders to become more involved in the issue that you just mentioned, the drone attacks, the feeding the homeless, the taking care of people who are in need. Those are the issues that our religious friends and the secular folks ought to be working on instead of spending 30 seconds being concerned over diminishing the rights for the gay and lesbian community. To think that there's a supernatural being who knows about all the negatives and problems that you alluded to earlier, that supernatural being is concerned with who has an orgasm with whom, It's just an insult to the supernatural being.
Well, Joe, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I realize, of course, that you don't speak for all humanists everywhere all the time. But I think as a thoughtful person who is involved in the humanist community, I thought you'd be a real addition to the tonight's show. And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. And again, if folks would like to learn more about our organization, Humanists of the Treasure Coast, I hope they'll go to their computer and look us up. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joe. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, just a little bit more news until our last contact joins us. We should be joined in a few minutes by Reverend Greg Wilson of the Port St. Lucie, UU Church of Fort Pierce. So until we get to that point, let me bring you this news, a Fukushima front. Tokyo Electric Power Company says it detected 300,000 becquerels of iodine-131 per cubic centimeter, which also equals 7.5 million times higher than the legal limit in samples taken around the water intake of the number 2 reactor at 11:50 a.m. on Saturday. It also found 200,000 becquerels, or 5 million times higher than the limit in samples taken at 9 a.m. on Monday. It also found 200,000 becquerels, or 5 million times higher than those taken on Monday. Monday sample also shows 1.1 million times higher than the national limit of cesium-137, whose half-life is 30 years. Japanese media. The Asahi Shimbun, January 10th, mentions that TEPCO withheld 140 measurements of radioactive strontium levels taken in groundwater at the port of Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant between June and November of last year. Strontium levels exceeded the all beta readings in some instances, leading the utility to decide that they were wrong and to withhold them from the public. TEPCO officials said January 8th. Previously, TEPCO officials said they had not released the data because the numbers were not confirmed. Company officials on January 8th insisted the utility had no intention to conceal information. They just did. NHK, January 10th, 2014. Nuclear regulators will discuss measures to prevent the increase of radiation levels around the crippled Fukushima Daiichi plant. The levels of radiation at the plant's border rose to more than 8 millisieverts in annualized figures in December, from less than 1 millisievert in March in the same year. Regulators said that's due to increasing number of storage tanks for radioactive water at the plant. They explained that the water basically emits beta rays, which are too weak to penetrate the steel tank, but they say that when the beta rays hit the metal, stronger X-rays come out of the tank. On Friday, regulators are holding a meeting of experts to discuss measures against that increase. The officials say they've been aware of the problem for a period of time, but they could not deal with it as they were occupied with issues of contaminated water. One thing at a time, they said, one thing at a time. Asahi Shimbun, January 10th. Radiation levels around the boundary of the crippled Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant have risen 8 times the government standard of 1 millisievert per year. Nuclear Regulatory Authority is scheduled to hold a meeting January 10th to discuss countermeasures. Radiation on the rise. Nuclear radiation at the boundary of the Fukushima plant has now reached 8 times government safety guidelines, and the firm has been struggling to contain radioactive leaks since the onset of the crisis in 2011. Hey, tell me something I'd like to know. Levels of nuclear radiation around Fukushima's number one plant have risen. Says Asahi Shimbun, citing Tokyo Electric Power Company. They claim the rising levels of radiation south of the plant, which has long been a problem. Maria TEPCO told the press, the primary reason besides the sharp increase in radiation was X-rays coming from storage tanks holding radioactive water that had been leaking from Fukushima. Let's see here. Radioactive water leaking from the nuclear site at Fukushima has been a pressing concern to the international community, as well as the Japanese population, since the outbreak of the crisis in March 2011. Luckily, it'll only be a problem for another 100,000 years or so. Let's see. After the discovery of water leaks, they have been siphoning off contaminated water and storing it in tanks. More of that film at 11. Let me all bring on the Reverend Wilson. Reverend Wilson, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
And how are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing well. I think I want to be clear that I am the minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Brevard up in Melbourne.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry about that. I couldn't read my own writing. So why don't you go give us that again?
I live in Port St. Lucie, so that's sometimes confusing.
Well, I'll admit I was confused. But, of course, this is the first show of the year, so I'm allowed a little confusion.
All right.
Okay. So, sir, my question for you first is to tell us a little bit about the UU Church or organization, if you prefer.
Okay, well, the Unitarian Universalist churches have been around since at least 1500, and you certainly see Unitarian Universalist belief systems since the time of the early church. So we've been around a long time, heavily persecuted at different times. That's why we're not as big as we might be. We have a not really a belief system that we covenant around, but we do more covenanting around principles rather than specific belief systems. And when people come to our churches or our fellowships, they are invited to come in and share their belief systems or develop their belief systems. We have a program called Developing Your Own Theology, and so we try to encourage critical thinking about what people believe and how you believe and how we, I guess, live out our values rather than just speak our values. So we're very conscious of that. I'd have to say probably the central principle that binds us together would be kindness. Are we growing to be kinder people to ourselves, to one another, and to the earth? So that's kind of the, I would think, a fair assessment of most Unitarian Universalist churches. There are certainly a variety. Certainly we have some that are more Christian, particularly in the Northeast, some particularly, more humanist. So it's a broad range depending on which Unitarian Universalist congregation you'd participate with.
Well, super. So,
yeah, we're very, very social justice-minded, very concerned that political policy and legislation moves us toward being kinder to one another, just like we work to be kinder toward one another in our congregations at large.
Well, I wanted to have you talk a little bit about how you would analyze some of these concerns that face our society today. And one of the premises of tonight's show, I thought with all of the enthusiastic religious celebrations that took place last month, I thought it was only fair to give my humanist and atheist colleagues a shot to talk a little bit about how they look at various moral issues. So one of the questions I asked my good friend from Joe Beck from the Humanist Association was when in his case a humanist, but in your case a Unitarian, when you look at the problem of the homeless, of feeding the hungry. Of course, we hear a discourse in Congress when it comes to providing extended benefits. We hear some say, my God, they need these. This is life and death. We need to provide funding. And yet others say they're looking at the bigger picture, and they think that this this creates dependency. How do you look at this problem? And what is your guidelines? How do you face this sort of issue?
First of all, it exists. Therefore, the system we have in place gives permission for it to exist and actually structures it into, homelessness and minimum wage, no minimum wage, not a living wage. It's structured into the very economic system that we have. So it's a given. It's going to be there. So the dependency issue is really kind of silly when the system itself produces it. You would have to change the system not to have it. The fact that we have it is an indication the system produces it. But I would say to deal with the homeless, my sense would be rather than have this aversion to homeless, that it should be embraced. We should have tents, maybe with air mattresses. We should provide counselors to see what exactly is going on, if that would be helpful. Why not have bonfires and guitars and sing-alongs? I mean, what we should do is create a space where these people can gather, feel safe, become known. We can understand what's going on with these folks, see if they're trapped in any way, whether it's a mental illness or whether it's an economic system or whether they just want to be there because they don't want to be part of this system. I mean, find out what's going on with this population and, in a way, be kind. House it. Feed these people. Talk to these people. Find out who they are. Give them a place in which they can have food, physical safety, and emotional safety. And let's find out why they're there and what's going on. And the people that want to make a transition out, help facilitate that transition out. And people that want to stay there, let them stay. Treat them nice.
Thank you.
Be decent human beings.
Obviously, kindness and decency sounds like a better approach than let them starve and make feeding them illegal.
Yeah.
Okay. Another one of the issues.
It's clearly a teaching from the Bible. It's a biblical teaching for the Christian folks. The book of Acts talks about the early church. Well, it's just there. Feed the hungry, thirsty, give them something to drink. The book of Acts, we sell all our goods and share it in common with one another. You know, so I mean, it's a biblical principle, so I'm not really saying something that doesn't exist in our primary faith traditions in our country. It's there. All you do is read it.
Good point. Obviously, not even referring to translations, there are people who obviously read that book quite differently. Okay, next question I was going to ask
There's
you, sir.
There's a blind spot. Yes, sir.
The next question I wanted to ask you is the question of drone warfare. Some people seem to think that as long as our troops aren't being hurt while we go out and extrajudicially assassinate foreign nationals or even Americans, there's no problem because, after all, our troops aren't in danger. How does a Unitarian look at the dilemma of drone warfare?
Well, I'm speaking for myself, as
sure.
any good Unitarian Universalist would, probably lean more toward the Universalist side of that. Drone warfare, first of all, you're talking about the execution of war. This is a tool for the execution of war. So it's a tool to manipulate other people to come into our way of life. We are using a tool of war to get people to conform to who we want them to be so that they will serve our purposes. It's essentially what an empire does, and that's what we're doing. And drone warfare is some of our most sophisticated way of doing that. I think drone warfare is completely wrong, and we should not use it. Maybe if we were being aggressed upon and we were really needing to defend ourselves, to defend our democracy, to defend people within this country, not defending business interests or not defending the economic structure of our country, which fuels transnational corporations, not defending that. If we had to defend the actual people, we have to actually defend the land of this nation. That's a different question than you're asking. The drone warfare that I have seen thus far is a defense of mostly the fossil fuel industries that are dominating, at least somewhat dominating, our political system. So I think it's completely wrong, because I think it's completely wrong that these transnational corporations are running our country. So I think their execution of war is wrong, so their implementation and the tools that they use are wrong. So I'm completely against it.
Great. And the the third dilemma that I want to challenge you with, and again, I raise these issues because all too often, those who are typically the religious right, or typically those engaged in what's called cultural warfare, want to presume and want to promulgate the idea that if you're outside the main theological systems, you don't have a moral point of view. You don't have any moral standing. And I wanted to give good people like yourself and my humanist friends and atheist friends a chance to show their side of things. When we look at the cases of access to birth control or access to abortion, which are so much, unfortunately, been made part of this cultural warfare. Let's take, for example, these laws that are causing so much turmoil right now, where on the one hand, organizations are being required to provide access to birth control, to provide access to birth control services, and yet they're claiming on religious grounds not to do that, not even to sign a form that would waive them providing that. How do you assess that issue of morality?
Well, I don't know if that's purely an issue of morality. If the organization is completely self-sufficient and it's my organization, say, and it's my funds that support that organization, so it's very private that way, you know, I can see maybe that particular person has some say that the federal government shouldn't be able to dominate how they practice, even if I disagree with it. But when you're talking about access to care and you're talking about hospitals and people have religious organizations that serve people that are not the religion that the organization found, like if I'm going to a Catholic church and I'm not a Catholic, should I be forced to adhere to the Catholic theology through that church? You can say, well, you go to another hospital, but you know, I don't think you should impose that theology upon me because you're the one that has the wherewithal to have the hospital. So that's obviously the organizations like hospitals have a relationship with the governing processes of our country. So there's a negotiation there, and the needs of the people should be more important than a particular theology. And so if we come with a decision that the needs of the people are more important than the theology, then why not give the people the choice? The federal government wants to offer some kind of insurance plan for birth control or for abortions. I think the people should have a greater say whether they get that service than some particular theological position sitting in a boardroom somewhere. You always
okay.
go with the needs of the people first, not the ideology of the institution, from my perspective.
Sure, that sounds like a reasonable way to look at things. Let me ask you this. More and more often, we're seeing the creation of commercial schools or so-called charter schools, which quite often have a religious flavor to them. Is the Unitarian Association looking to start their own charter schools?
You know, I don't know in this area, I don't know of any Unitarian schools, but that's not to say that they don't exist. Generally, though, the flavor of Unitarian religious education for children and youth is that we will teach pretty much all the world religions so that the children grow up with an awareness of the diversity of religious expression that has come on this planet and try to connect that religious expression to the geography from which it comes from, because there's an important relationship between the place and the religion that emerges out of that place, and try to understand that relationship and not really favor any particular religion. We would move toward the child and the adult to work toward looking at the values of those and determining which values they should use for their particular life and the community that they're in. So even if the Unitarian Universalist were to have a school system, it certainly would be a system in terms of religious practices, would teach the same thing we teach in our Sunday school classes now, would teach the diversity would teach all the world religions and work with the meaning of the world religions and what might be most helpful to us to move society in the direction that was more just and kind. So I would think a Unitarian Universalist school was, I would not have fear religious indoctrination from one of those schools. They would probably get dinged for not indoctrinating in a particular ways, my guess. I think it's a disservice to the child to impose a particular belief system on a young imagination that's beginning to flourish and engage the world, and then the adult world cookie cut a particular belief system and insert it in that child's imagination and say, this is the absolute truth. And so the child loses their sense of wonder about the earth and loses their sense of wonder about divinity and begin to believe they have the absolute truth. Yeah, I just think that's really kind of abusive to the individual. So my guess is a lot of Unitarians might fall in that category. We'd be against stifling the wonder of the imagination, which the indoctrination to a particular ideology clearly stifles the wonder of the imagination because it forces you into a particular shape rather than have you just kind of ponder and wonder about this world and come to your own conclusions. You know, that's where we would go.
So I'm going to guess that you're not a big indoctrinator of the term, the concept of hell then, I guess, for children.
Like I say, maybe if you don't believe in hell, you just don't go, you know. The only way you go to hell is to... I could never figure out... Yeah.
Go ahead.
I could never figure out the hell, the belief in hell, because if you think about it, okay, let's say you believe in hell and you believe that hell is a fire, and you believe that there are people in hell are going to be in hell for eternity in this fire, and they're screaming in anguish. Okay, if I'm going to go that way, then I have to hold that image and that awareness in my imagination. So no matter where I go today as I live, I've got this place inside me that's a burning hell with melting flesh and screaming and anguish in my head. And part of my imagination, part of my life energy is structured that way. I think, wow, what a horrible way to go through life is to have that. And then the fear that I might be going there, not just contain it within my being, but to have this anxiety about it somewhere. And I know people say accept Jesus and you don't have that anxiety, but you still got to carry around that anguish in you. And my faith perspective is we work to free ourselves from that kind of inner dynamic so we can feel the pureness of this planet and the life emerging that comes from this planet and experience the wonder and the poetry of this planet.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful segue because that allows me to bring up the last time I had the good fortune to see you, we were at a Citizens Water Summit.
Yes.
How do you see the organization, the UU, or what part of your own belief brings you to participate in a situation like that, in a civic movement like Working for Clean Water?
I absolutely believe, and this is some of the anguish that I carry around, that the behavior of the human being is drawing a close to the life systems of our planet. A lot of people don't want to believe that, but we experienced that on the Indian River Lagoon, and just come to terms with that, with climate disruption and the heating of the planet, and the poisoning of the water. Look at the West Virginia people. That's happening all over the world. We are literally poisoning the life systems of this planet. That is completely against my faith perspective that we should be enhancing the life systems of this planet. So what we do in relationship with that is we educate and we try to transform and we try to say we need a new story to live out of. We've got this wonderful conference coming up in February at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Vero Beach. We have international speakers come in. We're going to have people playing music, poetry, and people talking about earth rights and what does that mean, and more than sustainability, that we got to push and hold our sustainability, and then how do we nurture this planet. Whatever understanding of the divine you have, you would have that this planet is an expression of the creator or of the divine or of the goddess or of the god, however you would want to talk about that, that this planet is an expression of that. So to poison this planet is to poison our god, is to poison our theology, is to poison our goddess. And that's completely against where I am and how any Christian who believes or any person who believes that God is creator of this planet and then supports a group of people that poison the planet baffles me. You know, there's a disconnect there. So, you know, there's a CD missing in that brain. You know, no, you can't poison the planet. If you poison the planet, you're poisoning my children. No, that's not acceptable behavior. So that's one reason why I went to the water summit. You poison the water with your fracking, and I just read recently they even thought about nuclear fracking, but I think they've done away with that. But we just destruction of this planet for profit is the biggest sin that I know of. And we don't usually speak a lot about sin, but that is clearly to destroy. What we did the Indian River Lagoon is an expression of our collective sin as a human species in this area. And we need to repent to that, and we need to seek to change that in whatever way we possibly can.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about that event you got coming up in February?
It's called Healing Our World and Ourselves, and if you look up Healing Our World and Ourselves on the internet and Google that, you will find that. We've got speakers from Vancouver, a couple speakers from Canada coming in about, this one guy's great, Bruce Alexander. He wrote The Globalization of Addiction, a book on that. If you go to his webpage, it's wonderful. And he's going to talk about the globalization of addiction. Some of us in this area know Sister Pat Seaman, Director of Earth's Jurisprudence. She's coming. She's coming to speak. We've got Unitarian Universalist Ministry for the Earth. We've got representatives from them. We've got a fellow coming down from Vermont who has been big on promoting solar energy in Vermont and working with the legislation in that area. Got a wonderful band, Dock Street Band, who sings beautiful protest songs about earth rights and corporate personhood and just wonderful, wonderful songs that way. So we've got a fella coming in from the Unitarian Universalist representative to the United Nations going to come in and speak to us and talk to us about that. We've got some people that are local folks, Richard and Juanita Baker, who are involved in the Audubon Society, talking about that. So we got some local folks coming in. And all in all, I think we got about 19 speakers. We're going to have different panels and interview with the panels and places to discuss with these people. And it should be not just informational, but a real celebration of life and a celebration of the knowledge that these people bring to us and that we can use that knowledge to bring life back to the lagoon and life back to ourselves, really.
So what's the date for that again, sir?
February 21st and 22nd, all day Friday and all day Saturday. Beautiful concert Friday night. We got a soprano person, Shyla Nelson of One Earth, One Voice is coming in and is going to do an hour-long concert on songs of the earth, and she has just got a beautiful voice. She's also one of our speakers on Saturday.
Well, that sounds
so
wonderful.
Great that way. It absolutely is.
Well, Reverend Wilson,
so that
thank
be...
you so much for joining us, sir.
All right. Call me again, and we'll could talk more about this conference if possible. I'd love it.
Sounds good. We'll do that just before the event, okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay,
for your time.
And thanks for joining us. You have a good holiday and Happy New Year.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of our first show here in 2014. I hope you tune in next week. We have a wonderful show coming up. It's going to be Progressive Press with Carl Gibson of Art Readers News. Steve Horn of DeSmog Blog. We've got Hans Myers from Tallahassee. Alan Mackey from up in the northwest Minnesota. The wonderful Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push. Jerry Waxman, all-around journalist. And it's going to be a tremendous show. Hope you join us next week. Take care. This is Richard Spezak, News Director. Thanks so much for joining us. And solidarity, my friends. Solidarity.
One, two, three, come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin now with a spin, traveling in a world of migration. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Oh, anything you want to do, what do I want to change the world? There's nothing to it.
There we go. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.